Thank you, Dr. Muller, for those kind words, and distinguished faculty, administration, students, and guests. Honored to be here. About probably 35 years ago, a Sunday school teacher of a fifth grade class asked her class to write an encouraging note to the preacher. And I got a number of nice notes, but I've kept one of those from Kenny Ward for over 30 years. On the outside, he's drawn a picture, stick figure of me standing before a microphone on a platform, says to Bob Russell. Inside it reads, "Mr. Russell, you have to be brave to be able to stand in front of thousands of people. I'm glad you're a preacher at this church. I think you do a wonderful job. I am praying that one of these times you don't mess up." Signed, Kenny Ward. If I had my life to live over again, I would do many things the same way. I would decide my senior year of Bible college, or my senior year of high school, to enter Bible college and study for ministry. At Bible college, I would meet Judy K. Thomas from Rushville, Indiana, and start dating her and marry her. I would accept the pulpit of Southeast Christian Church at age 22 and come to Louisville, Kentucky. I would stay for 40 years and retire and pass the baton on to Dave Stone. So I feel like I've done some things in my life the way God would have me do them. But I've also made some major blunders along the way. I've messed up on some occasions too. And I've learned some lessons from failures about leadership. Lessons that have really benefited me. There's an old saying, experience is a hard teacher. She gives the test first and the lesson afterward. And sometimes the most practical lessons of leadership are learned from those experiences that hurt the most. That's true in marriage, isn't it? I wasn't married very long, and one morning I woke up and went out to get the newspaper, and an unexpected 6 inches of snow had fallen, and the sun was shining, glistening off the trees, off the ground. It was exhilarating. I am a morning person, and it just lifted me up. I reached down, and it was a wet snow, a packable snow, and I made a little snowball. And I went upstairs. I wanted my wife to share the exhilaration of this moment. And she is not a morning person. I crawled in bed and I just laid the snowball on her stomach. I will never do that again. It's the only time in our 50-some years of marriage that she hit me. And she slugged me on the shoulder a minute. We learn some of our best lessons from our worst mistakes. It is a wise leader who learns from mistakes. It's a wiser leader who learns from the mistakes of others. The Apostle Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians, the 10th chapter, "These things happened to them," the Israelites, "as examples, and were written down so that we would not set our hearts on evil as they did." We ought to learn from the mistakes of other people. So I want to share with you some lessons I've learned from mistakes that I've made. For one thing, I learned to confront disagreement when necessary. One of the first mistakes I made as a leader was a failure to confront when I needed to confront. Maybe it's because I'm a people pleaser by nature, or maybe it's because I'm naive and I think that all problems will eventually resolve themselves if you just let them alone. But I failed to confront issues that needed to be confronted early on. And the result was a permanent breach of friendships and a threat to the unity of our church. Southeast had grown to about 300 people, and we decided we needed a youth minister. I said, "I've got just the guy." I went to school with this guy. He's a friend. He's a year older than I, and he has a youth ministry in Georgia, and it's kind of uncertain right now, and I think he's movable. Well, those ought to be three strikes against you. A friend, a year older. Ministry is not going well. But the elders agreed. We interviewed the guy. He's very personable. He came, and for a while we had great fun together. But he wasn't on our staff very long when I learned that his philosophy of youth ministry was radically different than my philosophy of youth ministry. And rather than confronting him, I didn't want to hurt our friendship. I just kind of tiptoed around the edges and hoped that it would change. Eventually, the elders in private meetings were saying, "We may have to ask this guy to resign." And I would say, "Oh, no, it'll get better. It'll get better." But it didn't get better. One day I read an article that he had written to be published in our church newsletter promoting a teen all-nighter, and he was labeling it a teen love-in. Now, in light of the hippie culture of that day, and in light of some of the parents didn't have a lot of confidence in him, I really didn't think teen love-in was an appropriate title. And you know how it is, you get enough anger within. I marched into his office and I said, you know, I don't think we ought to call this a teen love-in. Let's get a different title for this. He had sensed the distancing in our relationship. He dug in his heels behind his desk and he said, I think I know how to relate to teenagers. That's what we're going to call it. Now, I've got insubordination. So in anger, I dumped too much, too late. He kept resisting, and finally I said, don't you realize this is the kind of thing that can get you fired? Which is really leadership 101. And I marched out. Well, he asked to be on the agenda for the next elders meeting. And he said to the elders, I think you guys need to know that Bob Russell's trying to get me fired. They said, well, strange thing, we've been trying to get you fired for the last 6 months. We've not been able to do it yet. He said, I am not resigning. That's not what this congregation wants. That's not what's best for these kids. And he marched out. That week, he wrote a letter to every member of the church saying, I've had a disagreement with Bob Russell and the elders. They've asked me to resign. I've chosen not to. I won't burden you with all the problems in this letter. But my wife and I will be standing outside the church building this Sunday. We've got a 10-page document showing you all the problems that have developed the last couple of years. And our congregation was stunned. They didn't realize that there was anything but harmony in the church. And next Sunday, they stood outside church, passing out this document, quoting, misquoting me and the elders, putting us in the most unfavorable light. And he conducted a Sunday school class that met in his home. And then about 20 people would march to church, and they would sit in the front two rows and fold their arms and scowl at me when I preached. That was my baptism of fire into ministry. While I was churning about that, I came home one evening and there were three elders from a church in Cincinnati. And they said, Bob, our preacher has just retired and we're looking for a replacement. We'd like to hire you. So I went to the elders of Southeast Christian Church and I said, look, I know I'm at the center of this controversy. I have an opportunity to go elsewhere. If you think it would be best for me to resign, I can do that. And to the person, all seven of the elders said, no, we want you to stay. We're going to work through this problem together. And I learned something there. If you have harmony at the core, you can go through a lot of difficulty. It's when there is disharmony at the core of the church that you're on shaky ground. I came home, I think, two nights later, and there was my first ever color television set in the family room. And there was a note on it that said, this is a gift from the elders. We're not trying to bribe you, but we just want you to know we love you and we hope you'll stay. Well, they bribed me into staying, and I went through that problem. And we got to the other side. I was so angry at that youth minister for threatening the harmony of the church. But the more I thought about it, the more I got away from that experience, the more I realized this was not his problem. It's my problem as a leader. Edward Demings, who turned manufacturing around in Japan in the 70s and 80s, had 12 principles of leadership. And one of them was this: 95% of problems are problems of management. This wasn't the youth minister's problem. It was my problem. I had failed to confront early on when it was necessary. So I learned some lessons about confrontation. I learned the importance of having weekly staff meetings in which discussion of issues was easier. I learned the importance of regular evaluations in which input and tough questions were expected. Somebody said, you keep your accounts current. I learned that you don't have to confront everything. You know, sometimes it's better to overlook an offense. A mentor of mine said, when you have problems, you've got to decide whether you've got measles or whether you've got cancer. If it's measles, just wait a while, it'll go away. If it's cancer, then there has to be some kind of operation. I also learned to wait a day or two before confronting, because if I confronted in anger, I exaggerated the problem and wound up apologizing for overstating the case and my mood, and the correction was blurred in the emotion. That's why Galatians 6:1 says, if a brother be overtaken in a fault, you who are spiritual, restore him gently. And you can't confront with gentleness if you're angry. I also learned that encouragement means more if it's balanced by an occasional correction. You know what it's like if somebody comes out, good lesson, good lesson, good lesson. All they do is encourage you. Eventually, it doesn't mean very much. But if the same person will say on occasion, you know, you said something today that I have a question about, if they will challenge you, then when they encourage you, it means more because, you know, they're telling the truth. That's why the Bible says you rebuke and encourage. And I learned that confrontation doesn't take nearly as long or as much effort as we anticipate. We had a leadership forum at our church a while back, and one of the guest speakers was Patrick Lencioni, well-known business consultant, author of Five Temptations of a CEO and some other books. But he talked about consulting with a particular business where everybody on the support staff and the ground floor of the business was concerned because the CEO was getting older and there was a vice president named Fred who was telling everybody that he had been tagged by the CEO to be his successor, and nobody had confidence in Fred. So on the final day of his consulting work, Lencioni sat down with the CEO and he said, do you know what Fred has been saying? And the CEO said, oh, I know, Fred's been telling people he's going to be the next CEO, but that's not true. He can't do it. People don't have confidence in him. And Lencioni said, what are you going to do about it? And the CEO said, oh, I don't have the time and the energy for silly stuff like that. And Lencioni said, time and energy, how much time would it take? Pick up the phone and say, Fred, this is the boss. I understand you've been telling people that you're going to be the next president. That better stop or something bad's going to happen to you. Have a good day. He said, that wouldn't take very long. Why don't we do that? Why don't we confront? We say it's because, well, we like people. We don't want to hurt their feelings. But the real reason I didn't confront, and most people don't confront, is because we're people pleasers and we don't want to feel bad. And the result is we all feel worse and the organization suffers. That's why the Bible says, if you find a fault in your brother, go to him personally. Work the thing out between the two of you if you can win your brother over. I think 80% of the problems in church would be resolved if we can just quit being people pleasers and be willing to confront. I'll tell you another lesson I learned. I learned to acknowledge my weaknesses and delegate accordingly. The worst single mistake I ever made in ministry was I forgot a wedding. Now, look, when somebody confesses a fault, you're supposed to say, oh, we understand it. Anybody can do that. You don't groan. Actually, I know that's the worst thing you can do. I had a lot of excuses. I had two weddings on the same day. It was Saturday, my day off, and the rehearsal for the one I forgot was on Thursday instead of Friday. But the bottom line is I forgot the most important date in this couple's life. And it was the day before cell phones, and I said to my wife in the morning, I don't have anything, I don't think, until tonight, that wedding. And I took my two sons, and we went to a Little League baseball game, and I came back at 1:30, and my wife met me at a panic at the door, and she said, Bob, did you forget you had a wedding at 1 o'clock? Oh, it's like I was just immediately sick, like somebody slugged me in the stomach. Oh, no, I remembered. She said, well, they got an associate minister to do the wedding. Well, it was our old custodian who just happened to have a ministerial degree in his background. It was just off. So I said, I've got to go apologize to that couple. I'd heard that old saying about if you've got a frog to swallow, don't look at it very long. So I said, I got to confront immediately. They're probably up at church taking pictures. Now, it is a 10-minute drive from church, from my house to church. And I'm a minister of the gospel, but you would not believe the number of lies that came to my mind as I was driving. I had a flat tire. I got stopped by a train. I saw a 70-foot high vision of Jesus and I was in a trance. I walked into the sanctuary hoping just the husband and wife, new husband and wife, would be up front. And the whole family was standing on the platform. The bride saw me as soon as I walked in the door. She said, oh, Brother Bob, we're so thankful. We thought we were in an accident or something. What happened? It took every ounce of integrity I had to say, I am so sorry. I forgot. Now, to that family's credit, they forgave me, which means they didn't shoot me. But I was so depressed about that. I thought, I don't belong in ministry. I especially don't belong in this ministry. And I have to admit my own weaknesses. You know, Romans 12 says, don't think of yourself more highly than you ought to think, but think of yourselves in accordance with the measure of faith God has given you. Evaluate where you're strong and where you're weak. And I am weak at saying no. I overcommit myself. I am not a good administrator, especially of my own time. I'm a disciplined person. I'll do the same thing every day. But I am not a great administrator, even of my own time. And so I walked into the secretary's office on Monday, and I picked up my calendar, and I laid it on her desk. And I said, I want you to run my life. I'm out of control. Here are the times when I will see somebody, and if anybody asks to see me, I will say, I love to see you, but my secretary runs my life. Would you give her a call? She said, first place, you're seeing too many people. We're going to narrow it down. And then she said, you're doing too many weddings. That one year I did 32 weddings. I said, okay, let's just do 15 weddings next year, first come, first serves. She said, you're also speaking too many times. I'm going to get a committee. We're going to decide where you're going to speak. And then on Saturday, when she's not in the office, on Friday night, she would call my wife and tell her what I was supposed to do on Saturday. And my wife would put a post-it note on the mirror. So when I shaved on Saturday, I knew what I was supposed to do that day. Now, I know what you're thinking. It is unbelievable that God would entrust a ministry like Southeast Christian Church to such a goof-off. But that's why. Because I acknowledge I'm not a good administrator, so I better surround myself with people who are. And all of a sudden, I started to be more in control. There was more white space, more margin in my life. And I began to be able to function. And I learned to delegate. Now, I will admit that it's not always easy. About a year later, I was walking through the sanctuary on Saturday morning. The custodian was setting up for a wedding. I said, got a wedding today? Yes. I said, who's getting married? And when he told me who was getting married, I was devastated because it was a family very close to me. So on Monday, I went to the secretary and I said, I know I said just 15 weddings, but when somebody like that asks for me, make an exception. She said, they didn't ask for you. Now, that's easy for you to laugh, but a lot of the problems we get into in leadership are the result of ego. We like being in control. We like feeling needed. We like feeling nobody can do it but us. But when we're willing to admit our weaknesses and release those responsibilities to others, life becomes easier and leadership becomes more effective. So delegate even if it hurts your ego. Ask yourself, why am I here? Delegate and don't micromanage. Trust the people you've selected to do the job. They'll do a lot better job if they feel like they've got freedom and they're not having to answer to you every second. Delegate in the area of your weakness and stay in the area of your strength. The longer you're in a leadership position, the more you ought to be focusing on your strengths. People talk about being burned out. People don't get burned out because they're working too hard. They get burned out because they're working too hard in areas where they're not gifted. When you're working in the area of your giftedness, it energizes you. And delegate to gifted people and make them look good. When Johnny Carson died, they asked a lot of entertainers, why did you like going on the Johnny Carson show, the Tonight Show? And they would say almost the same thing. Johnny Carson made you look good. He would ask questions, put the spotlight on you, and then set you up for success. That's our job as a leader, to select people who are gifted, and do our best to make them look good. Jesus said, now the Gentiles love the Lord over people. Not so with you. The greatest among you will be the servant of all. I'm convinced that the primary reason most churches never grow beyond 150 or maybe 200 people is this failure of delegation. Hit a ceiling. One man at the top can be the chaplain for about 150 people. But beyond that, there has to be a delegation of responsibility. Most preachers are like Moses counseling in the wilderness from dawn to dusk. His father Jethro said, you're wearing yourself out and these people are not getting good counsel. Appoint judges under you so that it will go well with you and for the people. The church cannot be a pyramid with one guy at the top meeting everybody's needs, or the base can only be so big. It's got to be a circle where we teach people to minister to each other, serve each other, then there's no limit to how big that circle can be. That's what the Apostle Paul was talking about in Ephesians 4 when he said God gave some to be apostles, some to be prophets, some to be pastors and teachers to prepare God's people for works of service. I think there are three barriers to effective delegation in the church. One is time. When your little child says, "Mommy, tie my shoes," it's a lot faster to tie the shoe than it is to teach the child to tie the shoe. But in the long run, it's wiser to teach the child. It's not easy to find gifted people of character and self-starters to volunteer or to be on staff. But take the time to delegate and teach, and it frees you up later. The second barrier is ego. Preachers can be control freaks. And we have to be willing to let people do it their way, not our way. The third barrier is organizational support. This is the most difficult one. Securing the total support of the lay leaders in the church of what you're doing and of the whole congregation. I reached a point in my ministry where I was overextended. I went to the elders meeting and I said, "I'm not doing very well. I need some help." And they jumped in and said, "Why don't you quit preaching so much on Sunday night? You're not expected to go to all these Sunday school class meetings." And then they said, "How many times do you go to the hospital?" I said, "About 3 times a week. It's early on in my ministry. They said, "Why don't you cut that back to 1 time a week? Just go when somebody's seriously ill. And we'll cover the other days, or we'll organize so that somebody from the church is ministering. We'll be that circle instead of a pyramid." Now, the key is, behind my back, can they support that? If somebody comes to them in the hallway after church on Sunday morning and says, "I was in a hospital for 5 days and the preacher never came to visit me," do they say, "Well, I'll go talk to Bob about that. That's not like him." And then they come to me and say, "It might be really good if you'd call Mrs. Howard because she's a little upset." No, they would say to her, "You know, we asked Bob to back off the hospital visits. And did somebody from the church come to visit you? You know, we're not a pyramid. We're a circle where we minister to each other." And when you've got that unity at the core helping you, and supporting you, you can delegate. I would tell the congregation, "Look, the church is getting larger. I can't be the chaplain of everybody. I only go to visit people in the hospital who are terminally ill. So if you're in the hospital, you don't want to see me coming. Somebody will be there, but not me." And as a result, the church was able to continue to grow because I slowly learned this lesson of delegation. A third lesson I learned from experience was I learned to give my family priority even when the church needed attention. When I was first married, I wasn't a great husband. I wasn't a horrible husband, but I wasn't a great husband. I took my wife for granted because I came to this church and it needed so much attention. It was so much out of my league. I was calling or going to meetings every night, and I was I'd take Judy to church and forget about her, or after church I'd ask her to wait in the car until I counseled with somebody really important. Or at home at night I'd let phone calls interrupt her. I'd bring work home, and I was giving the least amount of attention to the people who mattered the most. And I'm so thankful she never complained. I learned later she was lonely at times. You've probably seen that cartoon in Leadership Magazine where the preacher and his wife are riding to church and she says, "Why don't you switch roles today? Be charming and entertaining at home and sullen and grumpy at church." That was me far too often. Well, some things happened to wake me up. We had children and I'd seen so many preachers' kids go bad sometimes because of neglect. I began to be at home for my kids. But something else happened to me. One night, my wife gave me a phone call to tell me she was going to be late coming home. I answered the phone so late that the answering machine kicked on to record my call, her call. About 10 minutes later, I saw the red light on the answering machine. I thought I have a message. I pushed. I listened to my conversation with my wife, and I could not get over the lack of energy in my voice. Now, my wife has a lilt to her voice. She's kind of like Jesus. She's the same yesterday, today, and forever. Just wonderful to live with. But the conversation went something like this. "Bob, you having a good day?" "Okay." "What are you doing?" "Reading newspaper." "I just called to say I'm going to be a little late coming home. We got hung up here. It'll be probably 45 more minutes. "Okay. What do you want me to bring something home to eat? You want to go out to eat? What do you want to do?" "Doesn't matter." "Okay, see you in about an hour." I listened to that conversation and I couldn't get over the deadness in my voice. I just read a book by Bruce Larson that had a chapter in it, "Are You Fun to Live With?" I said, "Man, I am not fun to live with. If I die, I want my wife to shed at least one tear. I mean, what is she doing?" So I was convicted by that, and I decided from that point on I was going to be more energetic at home. Even though I was exhausted from what had happened during the day, I didn't want to talk when I came home. So I learned to shift gears, and I would say at the end of the day, "Lord, that's the best I can do. Phone calls need to be returned, and sermon's a little bit behind schedule, but I'll get it tomorrow morning," and go home and give attention to my wife and my family. I have a friend, Ben Merrill, who pounds a nail in the door between his garage and his house. People think it's there to hang a hat or something. He said, "That's a symbolic nail where I hang all the junk that happened during the day and leave it so I can give attention to my wife." And my wife and I have always had a good relationship, but the last 20, 25 years of our marriage has been so much better. We laugh more and more companionship because I learned to shift gears. About 20 years ago, my wife had a stroke. And it seemed at first she was going to be okay, but at 1 o'clock in the morning when I was in the hospital room with her, she had a massive seizure. She cried out knowing something was about to happen, and all of a sudden her body began to twitch and her face went into this twitching I'd never seen. I thought she was having a massive stroke. And I nearly dove in the bed with her and we cried out to God, "Please save us." And the nurses came running in and explained what was happening. And she had 3 seizures that night. And they gave seizure medicine. And she had reaction to the seizure medicine. And it was really tough. And I wasn't sure she was going to live. Odd thing. That week, on Sunday night, I was scheduled to speak at the opening night of our church's national convention at the RCA Dome in Indianapolis. I was to speak to 35,000 people. Many would think that's got to be the highlight of a career. But on Saturday night, the night before I was to go speak, I didn't know whether I was going to speak or not, and I didn't care. Why is it that we have to lose somebody or nearly lose somebody when we begin to realize who deserves the most attention? There will come a time when you leave the church. There will come a time when the elders barely remember your name. But hopefully your wife, your family, your mate will still be there. They deserve your priority. Not of attention, but energy. One other lesson I learned to be content regardless of statistics. Now, this is a lesson most leaders know in their heads, but it takes a while to make its way into our hearts. I'm a competitive person by nature. I like to win, and that's not all bad. I think competition is good. Paul Harvey used to say, "It's each tree striving for a place in the sun that makes them all grow tall." But if not controlled, ambition can be the seedbed of discontent, jealousy, and compulsive behavior. In the early days of my ministry, my mood throughout the week was largely determined by the attendance and offering figures on the week before. And no matter how good things were, it was never enough. Today's home run becomes tomorrow's triple in comparison. And I would tell people, 95% of Southeast Christian Church is great. One of the best churches I've ever seen. But 4% of the church is not so hot. And 1% is downright nasty. And my problem was 50% of my time was focused on that 5% to correct it. And I had a hard time keeping the big picture and enjoying God's blessings. Philippians 4, Paul said, "I've learned to be content, whatever the circumstances, whether in need or to have plenty. I've learned the secret of being content in every situation. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." That tells me contentment is a learned virtue for a leader. It's evidence of spiritual maturity and humility. And over a period of time, I reached the point where it was no longer about me so much as it was Jesus Christ. And my life no longer consisted in the abundance of people in the pews. I never lost my zeal for evangelism. I never lost my love for the church. But I did reach the point where I could say with Paul, "I've learned to be content regardless of the circumstances." There's a popular poster of an Alaskan sled dog team. And the picture is taken from the vantage point of the driver. And all you see the back of the dogs. And the caption of the poster reads, "If you're not the lead dog, the scenery never changes." Is that true for you? Have you got to be the lead dog all the time or you're miserable? If that's your purpose for ministry, you're going to be miserable because there's always somebody with higher attendance, somebody who has a bigger salary, somebody whose writing is more read than yours. And if you're comparing yourself statistically with other people as a leader, you're never going to enjoy the prosperity or the goodness of God. We had Max Lucado as a guest speaker in our church one weekend. My wife, who was in charge of the tape ministry, was elated on the way home. She said, "Bob, we sold a record number of Max Lucado's sermon tape today. We sold 670 tapes." I said, "That's great." Then I made a mistake. I said, "Judy, what's the most of one of my tapes that you've ever sold?" She said, "Well, that sermon you preached on worry several months ago, we sold 250 of that tape, but we sold 670 of Max Lucado's tapes today." Now, if she'd told me the weekend I preached on worry, "Boy, we sold a record number of your tapes today," I'd have been elated. But 250 compared to 670 is not diddly squat. And I was discouraged. I learned that weekend at that point that Max Lucado had sold 38 million copies of his books. 38 million. I'd written a few books. I had sold about 380,000. I said to a friend, "Boy, is that discouraging. I've sold 1/10 of the books that Max Lucado has sold." He said, "No, your math's off. It's 1/100. I was on suicide watch for 2 weeks or so. Isn't that silly? 2 Corinthians 10:12 says, "We don't dare compare ourselves with some who commend themselves. When they measure themselves by themselves and compare themselves with themselves, they're not wise." Let me tell you, one of the best decisions you'll ever make in leadership is to quit comparing. Just bloom where you're planted. God doesn't measure your worth by statistics. He measures it by faithfulness. Jesus said, "Some seed will fall on hard soil, won't grow a thing. Some seed will fall on fertile soil, and even there, 30, 60, 100-fold. So many times, the harvest is determined by the receptivity of the soil and not the genius of the sower. The Apostle Paul, who preached at Thessalonica, same guy preached at Berea. But the statistics were different because the Bereans were more noble. John the Baptist's statistics went down the second year. Big time. But Jesus said, "No greater man born to woman than John the Baptist." So sow the seed of the gospel where God puts you, in the field where you've been assigned, because the effectiveness of your leadership is not going to be determined until eternity. Now, I'm going to show you what I mean. I want to close out by showing you a picture of my home church, Meadville, Pennsylvania, and the long-term effectiveness of its leader, D.P. Schaefer. I don't know how well you can see this picture. We've all got these black and white pictures in our album somewhere. This is a picture of First Christian Church, Meadville, Pennsylvania, 1941. Now, I'll be honest with you, this is not a very impressive-looking bunch of people. Pretty sorry looking bunch of people, to be honest with you. And this is in Meadville, Pennsylvania, which is about 40 miles south of Erie. It's in the Lake Effect Snow District. I think it gets the third highest snowfall of any city in America. And it's a depressed area. I showed this picture to a group of preachers, and a preacher came up afterward and said, "Bob, I grew up in Meadville." He said, "I was in the eighth grade before I discovered that the Lord's Prayer was not, 'Deliver us from Meadville.'" And this is the kind of church that people really trash today. When people make fun of the church, here's prime example number one. You think, what kind of difference, what kind of influence could this out-of-the-way church have in the world? But before you trash this church, let me tell you about some of the people in this church and their long-term influence. On the front row is Sue Anderson. She's our church organist. She's married to Homer Anderson on the far right, who's a mailman. They may have been having a marital problem this day, but they stayed together for a long time. Homer and Sue had a daughter my age, Donna Cole, who became an executive with Team Expansion, the missions organization sending out missionaries all over the globe. She has a daughter who's a missionary, son Tim Cole, grandson of Homer and Sue, who for the last 15 years has been in charge of all the new church plants in the state of Virginia for Christian churches, done a fabulous job. On the far right is Stanley Betray. The far right there, Don. Stanley Betray, go back. On the far right. Stanley Betray married a little girl in the front row, Mabel Betray. Now, this picture is taken 1941, just before the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. At the end of World War II, Stanley and Mabel went to Tokyo, Japan as missionaries, and they spent 30 years of their life winning people to Christ in Tokyo. They're Japanese people in heaven today because First Christian Church, Meadville, Pennsylvania, and its leadership. In the middle are Edgar and Eva Pressey. Let me just say, not very glamorous people, but faithful people. Eva's holding in her arms a little baby in white, and his name is Arnold Pressey. Arnold Pressey is a preacher in North Carolina today, but when he was a little kid, his parents never disciplined him. He was a holy terror. And people at the church say, that kid is going to burn his church down. My dad taught Arnold in the fifth grade. I remember him saying on the way home, Arnold Pressey is going to wind up in the penitentiary. You just write it down. He's a preacher in North Carolina today. On the back row is Charles Ward. Charles Ward's kind of a stern, legalistic elder. Everybody's a little afraid of him. His daughter, Dorothy Haddenham, became a missionary to Alaska. He had three grandsons who were preachers. On the front row are my parents, holding my older sister, Roseanne, who grew up to be a great Bible teacher. She was single all her life, but she's one of six children that my parents had. I wish you could have known my dad. My dad was the 17th of 18 kids. His mother died when he was three. His father was an alcoholic, womanizer, not a good home. He grew up in a very dysfunctional home. At 19, my dad met my mother, who is a great Christian, and he gave his life to the Lord and never looked back. He broke the cycle. And he worked for 40 years at a zipper factory in Meadville, scraping to get by with six kids. But one-tenth of every paycheck went to the Lord. And we went to church Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. When I'm in the seventh grade, my parents start a new church in the little town where we live, 15 miles from Meadville. Started with 35 people. My dad loved that church. First one there, last one to leave. But we had a preacher early on who skipped town, leaving a lot of unpaid bills. And my dad was so concerned our church was going to have a bad reputation because a preacher didn't pay his bills. So he went to the bank in the late 50s and borrowed $2,500 of his own money. Paid off personally all the preacher's bills. Then took a second job working in a sawmill to pay it back. Now, when you got a dad like that, you're going to go straight into ministry whether you want to go or not. And so I became a preacher. I've got a brother who's a preacher. I've got two sisters married to preachers. I do have one sister who's a black sheep. She married a deacon. You got people in your family you're a little ashamed of. My parents have six grandchildren in ministry, a great-grandson, senior in Bible college. On the back row is D.P. Schaefer, the preacher. Just faithful Bible teacher, stayed in this church for 40 years. D.P. Schaefer's son, Raymond Schaefer, became the two-term governor of the state of Pennsylvania. Served on President Nixon's cabinet for a while. I show people this picture and they'll say, wow, that was a great church. Look at the influence of that church. No, it wasn't a great church. And most of our eyes, they had a lot of problems, never grew to beyond 180 people. In fact, not too long after this picture is taken, they asked D.P. Schaefer to resign because nothing was happening in the church. But look at 70 years later. The leadership influenced this preacher. And some of these people lives on throughout generations. You can't measure what happens to the seed you sow? So here's my question for you. 70 years from now, when somebody looks at your picture, what are they going to say about your influence? That's my grandfather. That's my mom. That's my small group leader. That's my preacher. Hadn't been for them, I don't know where our family would be. We're going to heaven because of that leader right there. I wouldn't be here today. Weren't for D.P. Schaefer, quietly serving behind the scenes. So my challenge to you today as potential leaders is this. Even though you're going to mess up sometimes, don't grow weary in doing good. In due season, you reap a harvest if you don't give up. Thank you.